Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 8th of February 2022. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Thanks for spending some of your Tuesday evening with us, and we're going to have an interesting conversation tonight about property. A lot of moving parts in the property story at the moment, so we'll try and pick some of those apart. We've got a few questions from the audience already, and there's plenty of time for you to ask questions too. Just before I bring Veronica in, let me just do what I always do, which is just put up my little warning. We don't provide specific financial or property or legal advice. This is a general conversation only. The chat room is moderated, so please just bear that in mind. This is as at the 8th of February if you're watching in replay. If you'd like to ask a question, use at Walk the World to make sure that I see the question. Very encouraging of as much chat and commentary to each other as you like, but if you want me to see it, make sure you use at Walk the World. I've also enabled Super Chat, which means you can get your question top of the list or indeed make a contribution to help us run the show. So I hope that makes sense. Anyway, without further ado, I'm going to bring Veronica in and we'll get going. Veronica, hello, how are you doing?
Hello. Good, how are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good, pretty good. You've changed your background now, so people are wondering what I was talking about when you had your bricks before, but it was very funny when you just appeared.
Gotta love a Zoom background.
Yeah, indeed.
Now I'm in a mountain range.
You're in a mountain range. Yeah, very good. Yeah, you get branches everywhere, right?
Not quite. It's a pretty bleak mountain range, this one, but
Well, look, it's great to have you on, and there's just so much to talk about with regard to property. But let me just give everybody a heads up, because you know you've got such a busy life with so much to do with property. Why don't you just run the 30-second Veronica story as to who you are, where you are, and what you're doing?
I'm one of those property experts, and because I've got this Zoom background, you can't see the rabbit ears. I'm a licensed real estate agent. I'm also a qualified property advisor. I'm a buyer's agent, but also what I am all about is more truth, transparency, and trust in the property industry. So I am co-host of Your First Home Buyer podcast and also the Elephant in the Room podcast. Home Buyer Academy is a business that I am a co-founder of, where we help first home buyers. And I also have a buyer's agency in Sydney called Good Deeds Property Buyers. So that's about it, I think. I don't think I've left anything else. Oh, a book. I wrote a book once about auctions.
Yeah, and did a few TV shows and all sorts of other exciting things.
Oh, that too.
But the point is that both you and I share a very important perspective, right, which is that there is a lot of, well, frankly, BS out there. There's a lot of rubbish spoken about property, right, and a lot of people are being deceived. And unfortunately, the industry itself is not necessarily always squeaky clean. So what we try to do is to highlight some of the you know, the things that people need to think about. And so some people say, well, you keep saying the same thing, but there's a reason why we have to keep saying the same thing, isn't there?
There is. In fact, the same thing. And sometimes I think to myself, every time I get interviewed, I say the same things over and over. I do add some variety, but at the end of the day, the truth is the truth. It doesn't change. And, you know, there's always a new audience, I guess. There's a conveyor belt of people that are always wanting to join the property ladder or climb on the property ladder, if you want to call it that, invest in property, make their wealth through property. And, you know, I'm here to make sure they get good information just the same way you are, Martin, and I love that about you.
Yeah, that's right. I always remember the first time you interviewed me, right, because you were going to come in and basically say, look, he always says property prices always go down, you know, it's blah, blah, blah. I think you might have been a bit surprised by the fact that there was a bit more sophistication in my perspective with regard to what I was trying to say.
It wasn't just that, you know, that when I first became aware of you, I was actually trying to find a methodology to be able to predict with any sense of certainty, you know, what areas have long-term sustainable growth, right? And so I was really on a journey to try to learn about those foundations, even though I'd been in the industry, I don't know, for about 16 years or something at the time. You know, this is really hard information to come by because it's so laden with self-interest, right? And so I came across you and it was your mortgage stress data. And I thought that's got to be one of the markers, surely. And then I started listening to your podcast. Do you even do that anymore? You do? Okay, sorry. I started listening to your podcast, but back then, I think it was about 2018, you were very negative, Martin. And honestly, I felt like slitting my wrists after listening to too many episodes. So I came away from that. And then I saw you on 60 Minutes, where they basically took your worst case scenario. And so I had lots of preconceived ideas as to what you stood for and you know, that you're a doomsdayer. And so, of course, when we started the conversation, I was happy to be proven wrong. Found that we had more in common than I anticipated.
Yes, it's quite interesting, isn't it? And it's interesting. I've sort of built out a bit of a network now of people who actually share the same view, right, that you have to go granular, you have to really do the work. You can't just take the high-level, you know, statistics and, you know, what the mainstream media report, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, you can't necessarily trust what the banks are reporting, right? Because, funnily, have you noticed all the banks have suddenly gone negative on property price trajectory compared with 3 months ago? Or remember, CBA 18 months ago was saying a 30% drop, and then they said 10% rise. Now, you know, NAB's saying 10% down next year. And even Christopher Joy is saying prices could fall. I mean, it's wacky, really.
Well, a question for you, Martin. So banks start saying prices are going to fall at the same time they put fixed rates up. What's first, chicken or the egg?
Well, it is a bit of a circular argument, isn't it? But, of course, the other point, the banks are very sneakily, deeply discounting variable rates now, right? You can get cheap if you're the right sort of customer, which basically means that if rates in the market go up, they are outsourcing that move to their customers, right? Whereas, of course, they've already lifted their fixed rates because they know that rates are likely to go up. So I always say to people, just understand that banks are more in it for their own interest rather than your interest when they actually start messing around with some of these rates. And it is very much a case that the costs of funds to the banks is already rising. And Westpac reported recently their last quarterly results, and their margin was squeezed dramatically. ANZ a little less so, but still squeezed. So they are struggling with how do they actually square the circle, right? And so one way is to get more people into variables so that when rates go up, they can just pass it through.
Sinister.
Well, whether it's sinister or just blooming obvious once you realise what they're doing.
But actually, I hadn't actually thought of it exactly like that, but you stepped it out and I went, yep, of course. Now, look, they're a business. Let's face it. Yeah. If anyone's thinking that banks aren't businesses, then they are sorely mistaken.
Yeah. Well, they are.
And they've got shareholders.
They've got shareholders and they're interested to maximise their profit. And unfortunately, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that they do things that are in the best interest of individual purchasers. And, you know, as I always remind everybody, if you think about the underwriting standards and how much they think you can afford, right, they make quite a big set of assumptions to be able to squeeze within their underwriting standards, right? Unfortunately, many people will automatically say, well, that means if the bank says I can afford it, I can afford it, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's not that simple. But once again, it's a great case of, you know, you got to actually do your own work and really think about what your real cash flows are, not what the bank thinks they are.
Well, and here's the thing, and it's the same with actually the whole buying process, the whole looking for property process, the whole evaluating property, the due diligence, pricing, negotiating, the whole thing. There are no shortcuts. You have to do the work, and it's really boring. I get that. And we'd much rather have a quick and dirty, you know, I want a shortcut to getting this all right and basically making my millions in property. It just doesn't work that way. I mean, every now and then somebody gets lucky, but at the end of the day, it just does not work that way.
That's right. Unfortunately, the real world is not the same way as the fictionized approach that is so often portrayed.
Sold.
Exactly right. Now, there's a few things I want to cover tonight. One of the most critical ones, and it's a very relevant conversation, is this question of deposit, right? Mm. Now, many people struggle these days to be able to put a deposit together. And we are seeing quite a proliferation of get-arounds. Never mind the deposit, here are some other ways of getting in, right? And you look at the government scheme, you can look at the shared equity scheme, and, of course, CBA announced this week their latest scheme as well. I want to get your honest view as to whether these schemes are actually as advertised, firstly, and secondly, whether they make sense or whether they don't make sense. And then I want to talk a bit further about what some of the risks may be for people who sort of wander into these without necessarily thinking it through. But what do you think about these schemes?
Yeah, I think the market is really ripe for a lot of these schemes. Let's face it, it's an obvious problem. And particularly in the tech space, you've got a lot of very clever people out there all trying to find obvious problems to create solutions for and make their billions, not just millions, billions. And, you know, I don't know, for every 10 of them, maybe 8 of them would be broken a year or so. I don't know. So therefore, it's going to become, I think, a very, very highly contested space. That's sort of my view on that. Already we're seeing some players in this, and that Your Home, I think it's called. There's another one called Coposit. There's a number of them sort of all starting to bubble up to the surface. Now, I view these in much the same way that I view government grants, and that is any assistance you get towards buying your first property should be viewed as, okay, what do they get out of it and what do I get out of it, right? So with government grants, for instance, most of them are designed to make sure that you buy brand new. So what does the government get out of that? Well, the government gets out that lovely little economic stimulus, right? So the construction industry, what employs, a million people in this country, you know, banks are lending more money. There's lots of wonderful things that happen when people buy properties off developers, right? And the government wants to continue that. The individual purchaser, however, is sort of thrown under the bus, because you're the one stuck with the asset. And if it's a good asset, great. But the odds are it's not going to be a good asset. And it's not me being negative or you being negative. It's actually hard data showing that the odds of actually getting it right are extraordinarily low. So go to these deposits. So Coposit, for instance, is another one of these solutions. And that is only available on brand new property. So automatically, yes, sure, it's helping you get into the property market, but into the most risky category or segment of the market. I'd run a mile from anything that's actually telling you what you have to buy. So you really need, if you're going to take advantage of any of these deposit accelerator schemes, and for instance, one of them, I don't mind the 5%, government guarantee, the deposit guarantee from the government. I don't mind that scheme, because at least it doesn't dictate what you have to buy. And if you go out there and do the work, working out what's a good asset, what will serve you and your family for the long term, you know, getting the right property that's going to be a long-term hold, that, you know, that's a great way to get into a market, particularly a rising market, particularly if you have good incomes. And there are certain people that actually do have good incomes that may have spent a lot of time learning at university, for instance, and get out there and their first job's actually good earners, and they can see a really good career trajectory, and they're going to have increased earnings over you know, the foreseeable future. So there are certain candidates for these schemes that I think suit the schemes, but the schemes themselves have to be looked at. As I said, you got to look at what are they getting out of it and what are you getting out of it. And if you can buy a quality property, get into the market, not overextend yourself, and buy something that you can afford to repay, and that allows you to get in earlier than waiting 2 years to save, or 12 years in Sydney to save up a deposit, then do it. But just be very careful.
Yeah, buy the right property. As you say, if you're dictated to in terms of what you can and what you can't, that's a problem. I'd also make the point, though, of course, that a lot of the schemes make an assumption that the value of the property will go up.
Oh, actually, right? That was the only reason that it would work is if the value of the property goes up. So therefore, you have to buy a really good asset and you have to make sure that it will serve you for a long period of time. And what I haven't dug into, I've been a bit blasé, actually, what I haven't dug into is the time periods, how they determine the value at which you buy into the property. Oh, God, what else, Martin? Because, I mean, these are all the things that I have to really spend some time digging into the nuts and bolts of these schemes, because, you know, if that's unfavourable, or if it absolutely you're overpaying in the interest for the deposit portion of it, for instance, you know, there's lots of ways that they can trap you into actually paying very high interest for portions of that property. So you got to look into the actual fine print to find out how they make their money.
Absolutely. And so, you know, the CBA scheme, for example, I think they've got a 5-year window, right? And at the end of 5 years, you've got to make a decision about what you do. So if property prices have moved the right way, you might be okay. If they haven't moved the right way, and, you know, currently prices probably are pretty much as high as they're going to be for a little while, you know, maybe, maybe not, but, you know, hard to see the same growth as last year, next year. In the UK, where there were some similar schemes of shared equity and those sorts of things, 5 years later, a lot of people ended up with a property that they couldn't actually escape from because the value had gone down. They couldn't move their mortgage away from the expensive one that was being offered as part of the government deal because the value had gone down. And so they were actually trapped in this thing that sounded good on day one, but 5 years later, it didn't necessarily present themselves as a really good option. Now, if you pick the right property, maybe okay. But the point is, you can't just grab it and say, whoopee, free money, right? There's a bit more to it than that.
Oh, God, yeah. There's no such thing as free money, as we've established with homeowner grants, you know. And also with homeowner grants, a lot of that additional government funds, free money, is actually built into the price of the property that you're buying. You know, anyway, it's not good. Yeah, but also, like you say, I mean, if you're locked in, like if CBA, but CBA is only a very minor shareholder. Correct. They've only taken a very small holding of that startup. But if there's some caveat there that locks you into who you can borrow from, or locks you into a certain interest rate, or, you know what I mean, that you've got to look at those unexpected traps, I guess.
What you say is read the small print.
Well, you've got to sort of know what could happen.
Absolutely.
So that you even know to look for it.
Correct, yeah. Because often it's not absolutely spelled out, right, in terms of think about the adverse scenarios. One of the things I always say is run the adverse scenario, you know. So let's assume everything goes really well. What happens? Great. But what happens if it doesn't, right?
Oh, this is how you got your reputation, Martin.
Oh, you mean, yeah, right. Well, you know, I just think that sometimes people get swept along and swept up and think, oh, whoopee, I can afford to buy a property, and, you know, there's one over there that they're just building, and, well, that must be all right, mustn't it, you know? So I'll just pile in, right? And as I, you know, I've said before and I'll say it again, it amazes me that you spend longer, or some people spend longer searching to save money on buying a new fridge or a new TV than they do on a new property. I mean, it's just, you know, the scale just doesn't seem right to me.
No. And the thing is that, was it, you act in haste, repent at leisure. But I think the thing too is that in a rising market, people panic and they think, I've got to get in, I've got to get in, you know, I've got to get in, I'm being left behind. And there's a lot of advisors out there that are quite happy to encourage you. And I say advisors because the property space is unregulated. And, you know, there's a lot of people helping first-home buyers and investors to buy off the plan. They're getting kickbacks from the developers. You know, it's a murky world and it is not regulated, and you've got to be very careful who you're taking your advice from as well. And there's lots of people that can encourage you to jump in and tell you that you just have to get on the ladder. But, you know, a lot of those people have not been in the business for an entire cycle either. They haven't actually seen the downside. So, you know, I think it's you've got to be careful, which is why everyone's watching you, I'm sure.
Well, you know, and look, I don't give specific advice. I just simply say, hey, here are some things you might want to think about as you put the various facts together in your own mind. So the way I think about it philosophically is you have to build your own mental model of the way things are and the way things might be, right? So don't rely on other people to tell you, right? Do the work yourself, right? And in there, put your assumptions in, but also run the, well, what if I'm wrong? What happens if this happens, right? You know, if rates go up, what happens? What if rates go down? If I lose my job, you know, et cetera, right? Because only then, when you sort of stress test that mental model, will you know whether it makes sense or whether it doesn't make sense, right?
I think the big challenge is that most buyers, when they get into the market, there's this thing called recency bias, and it's something that we all, you know, it's one of those behavioral biases that we're all succumbed to. And what that means is that we tend to think what's happened most recently is actually what's going to continue happening. And certainly if you haven't been active in the property market for an entire cycle, and look, technically the cycles are meant to last 12 years, but they don't. But there's been ups and downs over the last definitely the last decade, there's been significant ups and downs. And anyone who's lived through all of those will understand that what goes up doesn't continue going up all the time. And then it can come off the boil, and then it can go up again, and it can come off the boil. And you've got to be able to ride that out. And so a bit of research, even going back, and you can do this for free. You can look on domain, you can look at real estate, and you can look in the sold tab, and you can actually look in suburbs at sold properties. And some of them go back, I don't know, even I've seen back to 2015, so they go back a long way. You can actually go back, say Sydney, for instance, that had a boom that ended in 2017. Go back and look at prices in 2018 and then compare what they were in 2015 or compare what they were in 2020. You know, it's quite useful if you can look at similar properties in those different time periods and say, well, what are properties prices for something that you might be looking at buying, for instance, and actually compare that. And that will give you a lot more information about what can happen in that market.
Absolutely. Well, that's a good illustration of when really powerful information over time can tell you some really important things. And obviously, you have to compare like with like and all those things as well to get any useful information. But that information is available. And, you know, quite often when I chat with people about their property plans, one of the questions I ask you is, well, how much research have you done? You know, how much information... How far did you go back? What sources did you use? And it's very interesting that a lot of people that I speak with just rely on the for sale and recently sold ones in the property portals.
Well, right? Funnily enough, people often come to me just not even looking at recently sold, and they say, I can afford, you know, to buy my dream home. What's the problem, Veronica? Like, you know, and I'm like, yeah, but you're looking at what the asking price is or how it's priced according to the price guide. And you know, last year, particularly auction, you know, agents underquote, they will underquote as much as they can get away with. That's just the fact, because buyers don't tell the truth either. And then there's all this game that goes on. But buyers, agents underquote, full stop. How much do they underquote? Not a uniform amount, but it's always less. Well, actually 99% time, but it's less than what it will sell for. And so by just looking at what's on the market at the moment, you cannot judge what a property is worth.
Well, and of course, the last asking isn't the same as what it might have sold at, right? It's just the big gap. I mean, folks, remember that a lot of the time the actual sold price isn't disclosed until settlement, right?
Or at all,
if it's, because it doesn't have to be. So quite often what you find is that the information on those portals is distorted, which is a problem.
It's what the agents want you to know fundamentally, because if they're proud of the sale price, they will often want to publish it. But then you might have a buyer who's embarrassed at how much they spent and don't want their friends to know. So the buyers can often request that a price is not disclosed. Owners can often request it's not disclosed. But I can tell you right now, when the market falls, the not disclosed will go up because the agents won't want it disclosed.
Yeah, exactly right. That's quite cyclical. Now, I want to sort of just bring another case study to the table. This is one that I received today. I'm not going to say who it's from, just to protect the innocent, but it's a really interesting example, and it sort of shows the practical thinking that people do. So I'll read it out. My partner and I are currently living in Northern Beaches and have around $150, $200 saved. I've seen that prices for units do appear to be dropping slightly, but houses seem to be well out of reach within this area for us, right? I'd like to know your thoughts on potentially buying a two-bed unit in the Northern Beaches, not in a large development, maximum, say, 12 units. I guess the questions I have are, would you buy now, try and find a good deal and fix the interest rate while you can, or wait, keep saving and assess the market that has a potential, perhaps a future drops later, or look in alternative locations or try and buy a house? And then last part of the question is, or should I buy a property in the UK where the rental returns are better, and continue to rent here and let out the one in the UK, right? Which is off the wall thought. I mean, this is quite a typical problem for people, isn't it? Right, trying to figure out in this environment, particularly when you're not sure whether prices are going to go up, down, or whatever. How do you pick this apart, Veronica? And you know, where would you start the conversation in this particular case?
Yeah, I'd start the conversation. I want to know where they are in their life at the moment, and you know, how old are they? They got kids, how long are they planning on living on the Northern Beaches? Are they ever thinking about returning to the UK? You know, what are their long-term plans? You know, what do they hope to achieve with this property? et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it, you know, just getting into the market at any cost, the two-bedroom apartment they might grow out of really quickly. Or conversely, depending on their lifestyle and what they need, it might be the perfect solution for them. So that's the very first thing. I just want to understand what their needs are, both now, medium term, short term and medium term, long term, ideally. But we all know that if they're a young couple, for instance, this won't be their first property. So they therefore it needs to be a stepping stone, and they need to make sure that they maximize the ability for this to go up in value so that they can leapfrog to the next one when they need to. So I want to know all that first.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a couple of observations there. When you buy your first property, right, if you buy the right one, as you say, it can be a stepping stone into the future. If you buy the wrong one, it'll be a noose around your neck.
Mm.
Right?
You stay on the bottom rung of the ladder forever.
Yeah. And often, if you make the wrong decision, it echoes down, you know, not just in the short term or long term. Other point there is time horizon, right? So I've seen so many people make decisions on, say, an 18-month or two-year time horizon, right? And, you know, it's all worth thinking about that. Even, you know, if a cheaper property and the lower stamp duty, you are actually up for quite a lot of sunk costs when you buy the property. It's very hard to recover those costs on the first year or two.
Yeah, exactly. The on average, the costs associated with buying a property, and that's assuming you don't use a buyer's agent, right? But they're going to be around about 5% of the property's value. And when you sell, on average, the costs are 3%. So let's say it doesn't go up in value, that's 8%. If it does go up in value, it's of your purchase price. If it does go up in value, it's a little bit less than 8% of your purchase price. But, you know, there's risks because markets can be very volatile, and the difference, you know, between now and 18 months, well, I know plenty of people will predict, but I'm not going to predict what the market will be doing in 18 months' time. I sure as hell myself, with all my experience, would not be buying a property knowing I'm going to turn it around in 18 months, 2 years' time, unless you're a flipper, and then you've got to, it's a business. So even then it's risky.
So let's just unpack flipper, right? So basically it's buying something that needs renovating or otherwise improving and then just selling it on quickly.
Yeah. Right. And so that's risky for lots of reasons. One is the cost of renovating. As we know now, the materials costs are going through the roof, but also you're relying on market growth. There's particularly when you're buying in a hot market, you're hoping that market stays hot because you're paying top dollar for it. There's very little margin for error, you know, so people can get caught out in the wrong swing of the market. They need to have exit strategies. And if they've borrowed to the hilt and that's their one shot at it, then it's a very risky thing to do.
Absolutely. And just in terms of the Northern Beaches, certainly units look as though they are actually on the turn at the moment. Some of the data I looked up before I came on shows that they are beginning to move down. Not universally so, but certainly there's not a lot of growth there at the moment. There's also more supply coming on, which would suggest to me that probably prices will be a bit easier over the next little while for units. Houses a bit more complex because there's more demand and less supply and quite a popular area. And in fact, the gap between units and houses has widened, as it has in many other locations over the last little while. So that step up between the unit and the house is getting bigger.
That gap is an interesting thing too, because if you're talking, and a good example is a beachside area, right? So a coastal area where, and I don't know exactly where on the North Beaches you're talking about, because the Northern Beaches ranges from Manly right up to Palm Beach, right? So it could be anywhere along that stretch. Now, in pretty much any beach suburb in Australia, there's like a main road not too far from the coast, and the properties between the coast and the main road are always doing a hell of a lot better, always more desirable than the properties on the other side of the main road. So you talk about the gap between houses and units, that gap between houses on the coast side versus the non-coast side, that gap's getting bigger and bigger as well. And it's a very, very tough gap to bridge. And it actually, as prices go up and up and up, it is making it more of a challenge for first home buyers to secure a really firm rung on that ladder that is going to give them the foundation to leapfrog up that ladder. So it is it's a real challenge and a real problem. And unfortunately, there's all this conversation in this country about affordability. The assumption being, I think the first property is that that's where it stops. And I guess for some people it will be where it stops, but for most people it isn't where it stops. So you've got to be very, very careful that first rung on the ladder.
Absolutely. It's very important to make that first decision. And I mean, it is tough because sometimes there are psychological reasons and, you know, frankly, peer pressure reasons to get in, you know. The number of times I've heard people say to me, well, we bought the first property because our friends have all bought and we haven't, we felt we got left out, right?
Yeah.
Not a good reason to buy necessarily.
I was reading actually a case study today about sort of a bunch of sort of friends that had actually bought all these house and land packages in the outskirts of Melbourne somewhere. They'd actually bought them effectively off the plan. So it's like a subdivision that took a while to come through. I don't know how a block of land is off the plan, but anyway, they bought them and then there was a period of time. And in that time, the market peaked and then it fell off. And so they all had a substantial gap between what they paid and what the valuation was on settlement. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of people all in the same boat at the same time, all friends that had these lovely dreams about building these houses together, and they'd all helped each other into the same shitstorm, really. So, you know, it sort of sounds so romantic to go and follow your friends on these paths, but just because, you know, little Johnny stuck his head in the oven doesn't mean you have to.
No, that's
right.
Did
your mum say that to you and your kid?
Exactly right. Somebody's just commented on your appearing and disappearing microphone.
Veronica. Oh, yeah. It's a bit, sorry about that.
It's very funny. It's like like a large lollipop that just pops into and then goes away again. Just going back to that question, the other one was the UK. Now, the UK is quite interesting, right? There's a couple of observations. Obviously, if you are in Australia and you're doing something in the UK, one of the things to think about is exchange rate risk. Right, because you've actually opened yourself to a whole new ball game in terms of the relationship between the dollar and the pound. Now that may not be a problem, but it could be. The second thing,
the tax. Going to say that?
Yeah, but you go on.
Sorry.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, I'm not an accountant, but we did actually interview on the elephant in the room an expat financial planner, Brett. I can't think of his surname. Anyway, I was appalled and shocked at the. He calls it sort of the Australian government penalising expats. So this is expats moving overseas. But the other way around is that you've got, if you're here and you're buying property overseas, depending on the tax jurisdiction, you can buy yourself a whole heap of problems you didn't even anticipate. So you need to get really good tax advice from an international tax specialist before you buy in any country other than Australia. And certainly if you move overseas before you buy here or before you sell here, you need to get good tax advice as well. It's a minefield. The other thing too is that I don't encourage people buy for yield, not residential property anyway. There's other things to buy for yield. And so there's risks associated with a property at the other side of the world. There's just so many. I just wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that for a lot of reasons.
Hard to manage as well at arm's length. Yeah. And so you need to probably employ an agent to look after it over there, which means you're basically losing some of the yield already. The other point
that happens here too. I mean, you've got to do that.
That's true.
Wherever you are, really.
Well, unless you manage it yourself. But
Well, that's a fool's game, to be quite frank. There's so many ways you can do yourself over trying to manage your own property.
That is true too. But the other point there is that, you know, the yield that is quoted is often the gross yield. Right, which is the combination of the price you paid relative to the theoretical full rental that you would get, assuming it was fully let out. Right, that figure is completely misleading.
So, in Australia, on average, the costs that you have to outlay, not including interest costs, equate to something usually around the order of 23 to 25% of the rental income. So, and it's one of the reasons I think the bank only assesses 75% of the rental income as income anyway. But that's sort of across the board, whether it's a unit or a house, the ownership costs, including property management, insurance, maintenance, et cetera, equate to around about nearly a quarter.
Absolutely. Well, that's why I calculate in my models gross and net. right? Because Net is trying to get hold of the true costs, so the servicing costs, the interest costs and everything else, right? And more than half of property investors in Australia, in cash flow terms, are negative in real terms, right? Now, that is astonishing when you think that most people are quoting significantly higher returns from property. And, of course, if you look on most of the portals, most of them will quote the gross rather than the net, right?
So, well, it also goes up and down with interest rates, let's face it. And, look, what gets me, right, is that I don't think we have a very good way of measuring investment property performance in this country. I think you got to include the yield in your calculations. I think you're missing an annual ROI, right? But you've got to include capital growth in that. And that's often you don't get people combining the two.
Absolutely. So, well, it's difficult because one is, you know, cash flow and one isn't, right? So so I always look at both because you're right. So most property investors will say, well, I might take a small hit on the cash flow, but I'm going to make it on the capital, right? To which I reply, that's great, assuming the capital growth continues and when you come to sale, you actually can achieve it, right?
It's assuming you know what sort of asset you need to buy to give you the best possible chance of actually getting the growth,
exactly.
As opposed to assuming all properties go up in value.
Yes. We've said this one before, haven't we? I think it's a very important point, right? Some properties go up, some properties may not go up. So it's always worth, So going back to the question, it's a tough one. My own sense at the moment is I don't think there's a need to panic in terms of must buy now, it's going to be massively more expensive next year. Knowing what I know now in terms of where interest rates are likely to go, where demand is and all those things, I think there's a little bit of wriggle room to look around. But it is much more important to, one, be clear about what your objectives really are, right, which is your first point, Veronica, and the second is to know what the characteristics are of a star versus a dog type property, right?
I call them flyers, floaters and flops.
Flyers, right? Floaters and flops.
You want to buy a flyer, right? You definitely do not want to own a flop. And if you have one in your portfolio, get rid of it. And the floaters, if you already own it, well, there's a whole conversation around whether you should keep it or not. And it all depends on a lot of factors. But try not to buy a floater. You know, if you've got the opportunity to buy a flyer, then, you know, look to buy a flyer. Hello. I think, to the question around this comes down to, yes, I talked about, well, where are they in life? How much do they need as living? How long are they going to stay in that area for? I think that most people looking at the way in which, particularly in Sydney, prices rose over the last year, they can be forgiven for thinking, I've got to do whatever I can to get into this market as quickly as possible. I'm going to get left behind. The problem is that if you buy a shit asset, you're still going to get left behind even if you buy. And this is what the message is not loud enough. And obviously yours is and mine is, but, you know, that's the problem. So in their circumstances, you know, sometimes a great two-bedroom apartment, if it's an older style block and it's close to the beach, but not too close because you don't want the thing eroded by concrete cancer, you know, it's in good shape. Maybe it's got potential to add value to it. Maybe you could turn a laundry into a second bathroom and renovate it a bit, put floor, whatever. Or, you know, if you can add value to that, then sometimes there are ways to manufacture some equity and to give yourself, a bit of an accelerator on that growth. But if it's the wrong property for you, it's the wrong property for you, you know, and you're going to be stuck with it for a long time. So it could be a great investment, as in a good asset. If it's a good asset that you can improve and do these things to, yeah, you might choose to buy it and have that as an investment and keep renting. But that, for most people, if they make that call, that is a final decision not to live in your own home. And that's a hard one for people to accept. But you have to also recognize that even if you wait for houses to drop, let's be real, how far are they really going to come off when this market peaks? They'll come off, sure, but how far? And so when you look at Sydney, what happened in the last boom, so we're talking 2013 to 2017, I think the Sydney median house price went up, I think, 89% in that period, right? Thereabouts, you know, almost double in 6 years, pretty bloody hot, right? They came off the boil by 15% in 18 months. Over an 18-month period after the peak, they came off the boil by 15%. So great buying. Why wasn't everyone piling in the market then? It's because people are sheep. They don't want to take advantage of a down market. They want to wait till it falls further. But then they don't know it's fallen, it's bottomed out until they look in the rear vision mirror and they go, oh, that was the bottom of the market back then. Now it's rising again. And they all start piling in. And so it took 9 months for 12%, you know, for the market to recover 12%. And then COVID hit. And the rest is history. It's all just a cactus. But the point I'm trying to make is that prices don't go back to where they were at the beginning of the boom, you know, and unless you're in a mining town, you know, unless you're in a really volatile, ridiculously overheated area, if you're in a good, solid area full of owner-occupiers, you know, with a large proportion of owner-occupiers, an established area with not endless supply of, you know, houses, little houses on the hillside, me stock. It will not go back to the beginning. It will not, prices will not go back to where they were in January 2020. You know, they'll come back, but we don't know where they'll go to, but I'm fairly certain they won't go back to where they started. There'll be a new bottom, right? And then they'll start going up again. So you've got to be guessing and gambling. If you wait for prices to come off the boil, you have to gamble that that's going to be in your favor and it's going to be in a time frame. And that's a big gamble in a rising market. So you might need to say, okay, I'm going to move somewhere else. I mean, these are all the sorts of questions you need to have. You might need to decide to rent invest. But these are, I guess, being real about it and being realistic about what may or may not happen is very important.
Absolutely. And you're right, insofar that if you look even in the US or in the UK, where prices did drop, in some cases, they went back 40%, right? But they then came up again, and now they're actually much higher than where they were. So there was a period when they were in negative equity and all of those things. But ultimately, the force of pressure of prices and low interest rates and quantitative easing and everything else stoked prices higher again. And of course, I'd make the point that the international context of the economics and also the economics within the country and the focus among central bankers and governments to try and actually continue to keep property prices high rather than low is also something to factor in, right? Because you can't just take a purely economic view. You've got to take also a socio-political view as well. And I have to say that a lot of political capital has been invested to try and persuade people that prices will always be high. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to see somebody in the coming up election saying prices will always be higher under us. You know, that's
it's actually a tricky argument for politicians, because you can't say prices will always be high and think, oh, but you little first home buyers, we want you to get in the market and have affordability for you. You know what I mean? It's a tricky political hot potato, that one, to be quite frank.
Well, but remember that there are more people who own property rather than those trying to get into property, right?
Exactly. And every first home buyer, as soon as they became a home buyer, homeowner, they want prices to rise.
Yes.
So
and stay high.
Yes. No one wants to go backwards.
Exactly.
But however, you know, I say that about prices don't go back to where they were at the beginning of the boom. That is in solid areas with foundations, fundamental foundations that, you know, provide those, the foundations, I guess, for sustainable growth over long periods of time. You look at Darwin. Darwin's had a little boom, you know, because of COVID, but those prices haven't actually recovered where they were at their previous peak. But that is because you've really got one industry pushing prices, and that's where it's basically like a big mining town, right? And so that's one of the, anything that's just tourism or just mining or just whatever, highly risky.
Well, a lot of Perth property, you know, was higher a decade ago than now, even after the recent rise, and which is now easing off again. Same problem, right? Narrowly based economy, resource connected. But a lot of property there is still underwater, and a lot of people who bought in those intervening years are sitting on negative equity even now.
Well, they, in fact, because the pain and gain report that comes out from CoreLogic every quarter that tracks loss-making sales, I wish I had all the figures right at my fingertips, but I was literally just reading through the September 2021 report today. So even in a booming market where the whole of the country is on fire, 8.5% of property in total sold at a loss in that quarter. And this is a nominal loss. This is a loss, basically purchase price to sale price. It doesn't include costs, right? So as long as it's sold for a dollar more than it was purchased, it goes in as a profit. So that's 8.5% aggregate, right? Aggregate. 13.5% of units sold at a loss in that quarter. 5% of houses across the country sold in that quarter at a loss. In Darwin, apartments still. And the volumes have increased. The volumes of profit-making sales in Perth and Darwin have actually increased, improved, right? But still in Darwin, I think it was over 50% of units sold at a loss.
Yep.
And that's a better situation than it has been, right? So that's an improvement. And Perth had a better improvement, not quite as diabolical, nowhere near as diabolical as that. But it's a lot of these people are selling now because they've been sitting on dud assets for a long time. It's been doing nothing. So they're thinking, now's my time, I'm getting out. So there's been a lot of pain. When they call it the pain and gain report, a lot of these people might have made it might have been included in the profit-making sales, but they've experienced a lot of pain in all those years they've owned it until they made that time and got themselves free of it. So this is, it's really unpleasant for people when they have a noose around their neck like that.
Absolutely. And it is hard because it means that quite often you have to take a bit of a hit to be able to get out. But the trouble is that just expecting it magically to turn around and suddenly start improving, right, is a pipe dream.
Mm. Yes. And I guess the other thing that I look at in that as well is that a lot of these property and investment experts and guides and wealth coaches and property planners and all that sort of stuff, a lot of them have been responsible for putting a lot of their clients into these properties.
Yep, and getting commission on the way through. We won't mention that, will we?
No. Unregulated.
It is horribly unregulated. It's one of the things that people don't realise, just how unregulated this whole sector is, right? And by the way, property data itself is unregulated, right? The advice that's given is unregulated, unlike financial advice, which is considerably regulated. The whole real estate sector has some regulation around the edge, but not in some of the critical areas. So it's a bit of a minefield.
So the actual so I'm a licensed real estate agent. So in order to sell real estate, you need a license. In order to buy as a buyer's agent, you need a license. But I could be a property advisor and not have a scratch. I could have left school in year 10.
Exactly right. Worth remembering that when you see those YouTube ads of these people who say, for $60,000, I can do this, I can build you a property portfolio, It's not quite that simple, I think.
It's simple, all right. It's really easy to buy the shit that they buy, And this is the problem in a really hot market where it's difficult to buy property. People do tend to look for easy solutions, right? And so these people, they've got developers lining up to flog them stock. It is not hard to buy that shit. You should never pay anyone to buy something that's easy to buy.
Good advice. Now, I wanted to pick up this question from a little while ago because I think it's actually a very good point. We were talking about stars and dogs or, the three that you use.
Flyers, floaters, flops.
Exactly. Do you still look for the worst house in the best street? Great question.
That is one of those property myths that is just garbage. Sometimes, I don't look for it. I happen to find it, yeah, sure. But the thing is that sometimes the worst house in the best street is the worst house for a reason. It's not just because it's run down and needs renovating and bringing it up to the standard of everything else. It could be that that's the one that's in the ditch where the stormwater drain, or that's the one with a triangular block at the end of the road, or that's the one that's next to the service station in the corner of the main road at the end of the street. So the whole worst house, best street thing sometimes works, but I don't specifically look for it, no.
No, and my view is that it's a bit of a myth peddled by some. You've got to ask the question, why is this the worst one in the street, right? Is it structural? Is it orientation? Right? Because if it's actually in the wrong orientation, you can't really fix that.
Well, every street has not every street, but if a street runs east to west in Australia, one half of it's going to have gardens facing south, right? And the other half is going to be the better side of the street. But also you've got some streets are on sort of inclines, and you got the high side and the low side. So you could call it the best street, but I don't want to be in the low side. You know, I don't really want to be on the south side. But beware, because agents will say north facing when they mean the front door faces north, and that's not the door you want facing north.
Exactly right. And some of those things, you know, you honestly can't fix, which is a dog can often stay a dog, whatever you decide to do. So it's a bit simple to say, well, you know, of course, the cheapest one in the street is always the one to go for. Here's another question. This is one from Maria. I'm going to put it up on the screen. My question to Veronica is, what would you do, buy a studio apartment in Bondi Beach or a house outside Newcastle with land to build a granny flat in the back? Bondi Beach would be negatively geared. There you go.
Oh, God. If you hadn't said the granny flat, I'd go, yeah, buy a house. I don't know about outside Newcastle. How far outside are we talking? Yeah, they're two sort of extreme examples, aren't they? I want to go a bit more middle ground. You know, would I buy an apartment well located? I definitely wouldn't buy a studio. All right. I have owned a studio in the past. It was the very first property I bought. I would not own another one. You know, so I wouldn't buy a studio. It's too small. There's lots of restrictions on lending for your future borrowers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Newcastle, I've got, you know, I quite like Newcastle. I think as a city, it's a pretty cool city, right? But I don't think I'd go too far out of Newcastle. I'd want to use the same principles I use when I'm buying in Sydney, or if I was looking in Melbourne or in Brisbane or any other city, is that we'd want to, you know, you want to stay as close as possible to the lifestyle precincts, right? So that could be the beaches, that could be the actual, you know, Cook Hill, those little groovy little places, and Beaumont and Hamilton, is it Beaumont Street, Hamilton? You know, you want to sort of try and look at gentrifying areas. You know, I think was it May? Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm not an expert on. Don't take my word. I'm not an expert on Newcastle, but it's the principles apply that I would apply in any regional town or capital city, and that is, you know, proximity to the action, basically, and a gentrifying suburb. I wouldn't go too far out. So, sort of neither is the answer to that question. And the other thing with granny flats, do not put a granny flat if it takes up your entire backyard. I don't care how much extra rent you get. You devalue your property. It's like trying to sew a fifth leg onto a dog and reckon it's going to run faster, right? It won't run faster with that fifth leg on it. Basically, people devalue houses in family areas all the time, putting these whopping great big granny flats at the back, which basically mean it's only appealing to one type of buyer when you go to sell.
Absolutely, and I've come across a few of those people who told me the terrible story of their granny flat not working out quite as expected, right? For that very reason, because basically what you've done is you've cruelled the pitch, as it were, right? What you've got left is not what it was previously, and unfortunately when you come to move it on, it just doesn't reach the same level of interest. So that's pretty important. I'm of the view that granny flats, you know, you've got to be really careful. You can really make the wrong decision there, despite the fact that so many people seem to be doing it at the moment.
Look, it's had its little fads and phases, and I know quite a lot of real estate agents have done it as well. It's because they're focused on yield and they're forgetting that that is a very, very small piece of the property puzzle. And, you know, here's the thing. Yield, A, you pay tax on it. B, you actually can't reinvest that yield into the property. Right? It doesn't compound. And it's like, if it's not compounding, don't buy it. Like, that's the magic of property investing, is the compounding. You know, that's why you look for capital growth. Because, like, anyway, there you go. I'll get on that bandwagon for a long time.
Yeah. What we should do is we should play Veronica Bingo, right? Because there's a few things that we always want to make sure we cover every time we do these shows, right? And that's one of them.
Oh, have I said that before? Huh? Yeah.
Now here's another thing, high rise, right? Particularly the ones closer into the city. I'm thinking of places like Hurstville and places like that, right? Or North Ryde, or even out towards Parramatta. There's a lot of high rise stuff going on there at the moment. My data isn't looking at all positive for those investors who bought over the last few years. Vacancy rates are very high. In other words, the yield's very low. The price movement is still not up. In fact, it's quite often down. North Ryde is my classic example. It's still down from where it was in 2017 for a lot of high rise up around there. What are you seeing? I mean, you know, am I missing something or am I reading it right?
Do you know, I think Sydney's sort of in for what Melbourne's quite famous for, with their Docklands and South Bank and that sort of massive over development down there. And I could never understand how can you have a booming property market as and I'll go back to that sort of 13 to 17. How can you have a market booming and yet individuals are losing money on property? And, you know, and this, you know, there was something like 60% of resales of brand new apartments in Melbourne, I think in 2016, in the middle of that boom, 60%, if I got the number right, sold at a loss. Right? That's mortifying, especially in the middle of a boom. So that's what we've got here in Sydney with these massive big developments. And I guess that's exacerbated by the, you know, the overseas student drying up, the tenant pool drying up. And so a lot of these owners don't have their income source. They might be really struggling financially. They've got to support that rent, you know, dramatically reduce rents if they've got it rented at all. In a property type that is just cookie cutter, that there's oversupply in the first place. So it had all the fundamentals are wrong in the beginning and it's just compounded by COVID. So I just think, I feel for people who got themselves stuck there, not realizing, you know, because people don't invest because they necessarily realize they're taking risks. They think that these opportunities, I'm using rabbit ears there. They think these opportunities to buy a brand new property off the plan, how could you go wrong? You get negative gearing and you get depreciation and, you know, and people love them to rent them out because they're brand new and they just forget that they don't stay that way. And then there's another building built with all the same stuff and those people have got better tax deductions than anyone looking at buying yours. So therefore, who's going to buy it?
Yep. Well,
and then people... Well, I'm just saying people don't buy with their future buyer in mind and they need to.
Well, that's always the question. When you buy property, think about, can I sell it again if I need to, right? And the distinctive thing about property is if there are many, many others that are exactly the same or newer, right, you're probably going to have difficulty, right? And what have you got in a high-rise environment? You've got many, many properties, right? And then down the road they're building another one. Which means that if you're a prospective purchaser later and you're seeing the difference between, well, I can buy new or I can buy, you know, a second-hand one, well, if the second-hand one needs to be quite a lot cheaper compared with the new because I get a premium for buying new, a bit like driving a car, though, you then lose it when you enter it, but that's another story, right?
Same, but different. Here's the thing, right? There's the proof that the government doesn't give a shit about you when they're handing out first home buyer grants, right? Because they haven't thought about, well, what if you need to sell? Because you are then competing with the next load of first home buyers and investors that are incentivized by the government to buy the new stuff and they're not incentivized to buy yours, right? And that goes for negative gearing as well because the depreciation rules were changed. I think it was the budget 2016, was it 2017? It was changed. The federal Liberal government changed this in the budget to say that basically if you're buying an apartment and it's brand new and all the fixtures and fittings are brand new, then you get to depreciate everything. But if you buy that apartment and it's only 1 year old, you got an oven, which previously you might have had another 9 years to depreciate, that's wiped because it's used. And once it's used, doesn't matter how old it is and how much depreciation was left in the kitty, you don't get any of it. So why would an investor who was foolishly making decisions based on tax, so they're making decisions for the wrong reasons anyway, but that's beside the point because the fact is that the tax regime, the government, the negative gearing is set up to encourage them to buy brand new, not to buy your one that you bought brand new because you got sucked in by the same you know enticements. And when you go to sell, you haven't thought about who's going to buy mine.
Yes, that's right. And interestingly, of course, some agents then try and ration how many they put on the market at one point in time. Right? Have you noticed that? You know,
They have to. And the other thing that they'll do, they'll like, right, you got 10 of you, you all want to sell. Who wants to sell for the cheapest? I'll list yours first.
Exactly. Yeah. And, of course, the other problem is that vacancy rates are very high, which means you're not necessarily getting any income anyway, right? So you've got this empty property. Again, I've spoken to quite a few people recently who've got multiple empty investment properties, right? And the prospect of trying to get rid of it, right, get rid of the problem, take a capital hit versus hope that it will somehow magically bounce back. When the borders open, you know, I'll suddenly get this surge of foreigners all coming in and students and that, you know, that it'll be fine. You know, why not? Yeah, maybe
why
not.
Why am I talking to you? I mean, that's wishful thinking on steroids. That is like willful blindness. Like, come on, face it. And it's painful. I know it's painful. Don't get me wrong. I'm not heartless. I might sound it, but I'm not. I want to stop people from making these silly mistakes. You know, I really want to prevent people from getting themselves in this situation. But once you're in the situation, you've got to face up to it and get yourself out and suffer the consequences, because they're going to be consequences. And the sooner you do that, the better. Pain is not going to go away.
Right. And there's another little principle here is that, you know, if you think about property, right, property consists of land and the thing on the land, right? And generally you can say that the land is worth something, it'll probably hold its value and maybe even go up, right? The stuff that's built on the property, on the land, right, the materials and everything, right, is probably not going to go up. It's, you know, more likely to go down as it deteriorates. But if you've got a high rise, then you've got a much smaller proportion of access to the land. So by definition, the asset that you think you've got is probably not what you've got.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, dear. And look, you know what? It's interesting. Who was I talking to today? I think I was talking to Kent about apartments with views, right? A lot of people say, oh, you can't be built out. Like it's, you know, it's on the 25th floor, can't be built out. Not unless there's another high rise next to you being built 26 floors, but you know, I've been in a lot of really crappily built apartments in my time and good ones. And I tell you what, the sorts of properties that tend to get better interest from buyers are those that are better built. You know, I'm not saying a view doesn't count, but a bit better built with a decent outlook, it doesn't even have to be a view, will actually over time perform better than a really shoddily built building with really bad floor plans and really horrible sort of just, you know, lots of things wrong with it. Even if it's got an amazing view, the view is not enough to tide it over.
Yep, absolutely. Well, I bought my current house 10 years ago and it was built by a builder for his own use, right? So it wasn't one of these, you know, build and sell. It was actually build and lived in, right? And the quality of the fittings and the way the thing was built is streets ahead of stuff that you see thrown together for a quick profit, right? So there is a difference of quality of construction, the quality of materials and the quality of the quality of the fittings. So the chances are that it's going to perhaps be a little bit more value longer because of it. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, we did an exercise some years back and we're looking at a property in Strathfield. And at the time, there's quite a lot of knockdown rebuilds in Strathfield. And we sort of look at properties that have been knocked down and a project home been built on them versus ones that are in similar streets, similar size block of land that somebody gone and had an architect designed, you know, bespoke build. And this is some years back, but the project-y style homes, they were sort of selling at the time for around about $3 million, and the architect design ones were selling around about $4 million. Same sort of suburb, same suburbs, similar streets, same block of land size. Yeah. So it did in the terms of the resale, and it comes back to that scarcity. Let's face it, the dime a dozen, the project homes, the architect design. Apart from the fact that, you know, I guess you would hope it's got some better design elements. Obviously different build quality as well in terms of, you know, might be double brick versus brick veneer, you know, or brick veneer downstairs and usually sort of some sort of clad upstairs. Yeah, I was amazed actually, that difference.
Absolutely. Now, I just want to pick up this one from Dylan because he asked in response to your comment, don't understand how a granny flat can devalue a property. Does it only apply if it takes up the entire backyard or if it's an investment property, I'm literally about to build one.
My perfect timing for you. Okay, the way that a granny flat can devalue a property is if people are putting it on purely to increase their yield and they're not thinking of the property as a whole, right? So if you've got a house and it might be a family home, family-sized home, and there's got a backyard that is an appropriate size for that size home, for the internal accommodation, and that means that a family would live in there and then the family's got little kids and the little kids will be running around playing in that backyard. That's what everybody wants in that sort of setup. But what a lot of these people have been doing, they've been coming along and go, great, there's room for a granny flat out there. I can basically give them access down the driveway and I can get two lots of rent. And so they plonk a granny flat in the backyard. And so what's left? You've got a big house at the front without a yard for the kids to play in, or they can play in the front yard, but then they're going to get run over or nabbed by some passing, you know, I don't know, horrible person, right? So immediately, like, okay, you might get people renting it, but they're not buying it forever. They basically will rent it until they can find somewhere better with a backyard that's secure for the kids. And then the granny flat, well, even then they've got no privacy. They've got no outdoor space because the tiny little piece of outdoor space that's left is actually left for the front house, which they don't use anyway because it's too small to kick a ball around and all that sort of stuff. So it basically makes both properties undesirable. Right. And so therefore you reduce the market. Anybody that then wants to go and buy a family home goes, oh, but if only they hadn't put that granny flat out the back. And so those buyers won't touch it. And then you go, oh, I'm an investor, I'll buy it. Yay, great yield. Oh, but I really wanted to put a granny flat in myself because that's how you make all your money. Oh, this one's already done. I'll go and find one that hasn't been done and I'll ruin that one. And that's the sort of, you sort of carved out. You've got one type of buyer. Oh, I want a home and my kids are a bit older and they don't need to kick the ball out the back and mum's going to move in and she's going to live out the back. And you've got to find that buyer. So the minute you start limiting your future buyer pool, you actually massively kick yourself in the guts in terms of capital growth. And that's how you can devalue a property with a granny flat.
Yeah, absolutely. Great as
well. If, however, it's big enough to have both and they're both really nice, go for it.
Yeah. So it does depend on how much land you got and how much it eats up. But unfortunately, many times, there's not a lot left. There was a whole bunch of questions about doggy cam. So let me just switch across to doggy cam briefly for those people who enjoy. There you go. Vanessa was late. There you go. So that's Meteor sound asleep. Luna sound asleep. Completely out of it now. So they aren't stuffed. They are real. But there you go for those who wanted the doggy cam. I love it.
So nice.
Yeah. Well, they're a very important part of the family these days. And, of course, they've got nowhere else to go, so they have to stay with me now. So, now, here's an interesting question, and thank you very much for the super chat, Dead and Regret. Opinion on interest rates, up to target or come crashing down, maybe even negative once it starts to affect house prices. So are we really in an interest rate cycle, or do we think we're going to go up a little bit and then come back? What do you think?
About interest rates, you think they'll come up? Well, I think we're getting enough warnings that they're going to. Mm. And actually, the banks are doing it themselves, you know.
Yep.
You know, anyway, look, yes, when interest rates go up, well, when, excuse me, when interest rates go down, prices go up. When interest rates go up, prices will probably come down. How far, once again, you know.
Yeah, so my view is that we are going to see rates go up. But the question is, will they stay up or will it actually create a deflationary impact that then actually take rates down again? And, then, you know, if they go down again to get any sort of impact compared with what the previous, they have to go negative, right? Mm. So that is still a live scenario in my models and very uncertain. But I do think we are going to see rates rise over the next little while. I think the Reserve Bank maybe bounced into putting rates up sooner than they think, because of what's happening in the US and in the UK and elsewhere. I noticed that the bond yields were very, very strong, which is a sort of a forward indicator of future rates. And I know that the banks are having to pay a lot more for their funding at the moment, which means their margins are getting squeezed, which means that essentially they're going to have to put rates up. So I think mortgage rates are going up. And I always say to people, you know, you've got to do some sensitivity analysis on what happens if rates go up. Don't just take the current rate, or worse still, just take the bank says, well, yeah, of course you can afford the margin, right? Do the math, work out precisely what it could mean to you if rates went up 2 or 3%. How would you cope with that, right? Because you can't assume rates are going to stay rock bottom where they've been temporarily, at least.
No, I mean, it's been wonderful, hasn't it? I mean, we've all enjoyed much, much more mortgages, repayments. But, you know, you and I, well, I'm sure you remember much higher rates.
Oh, yes.
I remember locking in half of my first mortgage at, I think it was 9.85%, and thinking I was on a winner because I had friends that had previously been on 17%. So it's all relative.
It is all relative, that's right, although – yes. Who knows?
Although, obviously, it will, you know, every rate rise then reduces people's borrowing power,
correct,
of course.
Yes.
And that's obviously going to have an impact on prices. But there are, you know, different areas. It's interesting. I talked to a number of different mortgage brokers, and people don't always borrow to their maximum. And I know that first home buyers probably will. And that's why, one of the reasons why first home buyers are the most vulnerable segment of the market. One reason why we created Home Buyer Academy, to look after those that want to be looked after, you know, and to help them get there safely. But, you know, that, but fundamentally, you know, we've still got quite a high level of, advance payments on our mortgages in this country. I mean, it's not at all a terrible doom and gloom story in terms of the, our sort of financial health. But I do think individuals need to be work through, I guess, you know, what they're going to do, like you say, you know, run through those scenarios. And one of the other things I will say too is that if you have to refinance in order to reduce your repayments, which is an option for some people, then you can only really do that if your property's gone up in value, you know, successfully anyway, right? And certainly if it has gone down in value, you can have a real problem refinancing. But even if it's the same, you know, I don't know. It's sort of not much point, I guess. You can extend your loan, but, you know, this is why equity and capital growth is so important, is really what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, spot on. Well, the point is that more people are getting 35-year mortgages now than previously, right? It used to be 20 years, 25 years, right? Again, the point now where your mortgage is more like rent.
Yes.
Right.
Well, you know, and this is the thing too. I talk to a lot of people, you know, as all different ages, and I do like to know who's intending to go into retirement holding debt on their home. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, I don't think it's ideal personally.
No, it's not. But more people are. And then, of course, they get a rude shock and have to raid superannuation to pay the mortgage down, which means they then actually have less to live off or go on the pension, right? So ultimately the government picks up the price tag. But that's a whole nother story. Let me just throw this one up. This is from Jason. A round of drinks for all. Hit the like button, people. And can you show the doggy can, which I did. So there you go, Jason. I really appreciate the contribution there. Thank you so much. That's really great. And just going down the list, from Jeff, thank you, Jeff. Appreciate the super chat and a bit of applause there. Somebody else said, shocked the government doesn't care. We were talking about the reasons that they were doing what they were doing. And Fraser actually made the point that I made, that with a high-rise apartment, you're basically buying a depreciating building with a very little appreciation, and the land component is so small, which is exactly the problem. Okay, I think that was another question. Let's have a look. Yes, okay. We'll put this one up. We've seen stocks correct massively to account for rising rates, yet house prices keep going up. How come the housing market isn't pricing in future rate rises?
It doesn't operate the same way, does it?
No. Entry costs are different, for starters. The time horizon over which you can transact is very different. And you don't have the same derivatives exposure as you do in stocks. Remember that there's a huge sort of system at the moment where the derivatives is multi times the underlying base of stocks, and you've got people using computer trading to sort of, you know, move against it. Now, there are people who've been trying to create derivatives against property, right, and to trade indices. I think that's a mistake personally. The idea of the argument is it provides more liquidity. No, it doesn't. It just creates more speculative opportunity. But you're right, Veronica. It is a different dynamic, isn't it?
Look, it is, because at the end of the day, a lot of, if you own a quality asset, what we always see in the property market, if there is some sort of sudden selling, and so in the stock market, sudden selling happens immediately and trades happen immediately, right? Whereas property takes a while to actually get on the market and then find a buyer to sell. And that's, that days on market is one of the markers of what's happening in the market, how that extends out, you know. And so the very fact that it takes longer to sell a property means that it doesn't, you know, it's just an illustration of how it trades very differently to the stock market. But also trying to find out what a daily value of property is, it's impossible. And I know there's been lots of people try to create it, but it's just garbage. Yeah. And also the other one thing I will say as well is that what you find, the people who own good assets, they don't have to sell usually. And then unless they really have to sell, they will take it off the market and they'll go, bugger, I'll wait till a better time. I know it'll do well. I'll do better at a better time. And so that's why you don't see fire sales in established suburbs. You might see them in a high-rise block where everyone's got the same problem, but you're not going to see them, or in house land package area in a new subdivision if everyone's got the same sort of debt problem. And but you're not going to see that in established areas.
No, it's a very different dynamic. And again, you go back to the same point. Property is not uniform, right? You know, units, apartments, different places, houses, you know, everything else. Now, there was another question I got earlier on about the Sunshine Coast. Somebody was asking, what's the outlook for Queensland and the Sunshine Coast? Now, of course, you don't cover that directly, but it is worth noting that there's been a very strong rise in Brisbane property and Sunshine Coast in particular. Mostly houses, so differentially the same thing, units less so, houses more so. Quite a lot of them are investments. And I'm still seeing some potential growth there, I think, over the next year or so, not least because there's still this interstate migration thing going on.
Absolutely. I mean, Megan Wells is my business partner at Home Buyer Academy, and she's a Brisbane-based buyer's agent. She also has one of her team does the Sunshine Coast, and she does talk very much about that migration coming from most of the southern states. I think Sunshine Coast is nicer than Brisbane. So even if I was living in Brisbane, I think, you know what, I can work from home. I'm going up Sunny Coast. So I'm going to get rid of this hot, stinky, sweaty, friggin' humid river-based city. I want to get to the coast, you know. The river's just like, ugh, second rate.
I agree. Well, I have to agree with you on Sunshine Coast. It's one of my favourite
areas. Beautiful up there.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
They've still got koalas there as well.
Well, it's yeah, they do. It is no surprise, really, with work from home becoming, you know, a thing, whether it's a permanent thing at the same rate that it's currently a thing or not, who knows. But it's no surprise, really, the migration to Brisbane on one hand, but secondly, you know, from Brisbane and extending from Brisbane to even the Gold Coast, not that I love the Gold Coast, I don't really, but, you know, the Sunshine Coast, it's got all over the Gold Coast. It's no real surprise that those areas are doing very, very well.
And I'll make the point again, your point earlier on about close to the beach, up to that road, you know, absolutely the case on the Sunshine Coast, right?
If you go the Bruce Highway?
If you go into the hinterland, right, completely different dynamic.
Yeah.
But so it's quite a narrow strip, which is quite interesting as well.
Well, but, you know, like if you think about around Byron Bay, for instance, or Suffolk Park, you know, the suburb just south of Byron, you know, that's got, is it Broken Head or whatever the road is anyway, going through it. And certainly the properties on the coast side do very well, much, much better than all the subdivisions on the other side. However, you go a bit further into the hinterland, that's a whole different market again.
Yep.
It's beautiful. But apparently I've been hearing that there's quite a lot of lifestyle blocks. There's a lot of people deciding to cash out up there at the moment. So, you know, those prices went stupid. A lot of Sydney siders going up there, basically. Everyone dreams of going to Byron when you live in Sydney. And, you know, so they'd be pushing the prices up, and now the locals have said, right, that's it, I'm out. Yeah, you know, if there's a saturation of stock, I filmed the show, so Location, 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 Australia, the show with the most syllables in it. We did a number of episodes up that way and back. So when were we filming? Sort of around 2012, 13, around that time, 2010, you know, there were properties up there that had been on the market for years, you know. And that was a long period. They have to wait before they can find a buyer, and a lot of them selling for a loss. So that can happen again.
Yeah.
You know.
No, very good point. I think the market up there will be a bit fickle going ahead. So now, Jeff made a point which is worth picking up. Those historic high interest rates were on loans that were not as large as today. Many variables to consider, but that's a conversation for me. Well,
yeah. Well, what's the proportion of income, though?
Yeah, that, so if you think of it in repayment terms, it probably was quite high. But, of course, the loan today is a lot bigger. So the loan-to-income ratio is a lot bigger than it was. So, in fact, the affordability is much more graded than you might think compared to back then and now, right, because people have a bigger loan. And, of course, in Sydney, it takes 10 to 12 years to save for a deposit, right, to start with. But also people are actually still getting at 8 to 10 times income to be able to get into the market, right, which is a huge ratio. And it still puts them at a roughly similar proportion of total income to what they were doing when the rates were a lot higher. So it's actually sort of eased out to be rather similar because of all the other variables.
Interesting. Let me tell you, I was at university when the interest rates were that high, and I was working in a restaurant as a waiter. And a lot of the people that I worked with had taken second jobs to pay their mortgage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that was a really common thing. And that's how I had friends with mortgages at that rate when I was still in my late teens. So, and I think that's what people will do once you've got a mortgage. You will do what you can. You'll start driving an Uber or something, you know, like to keep the property.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people, of course, now have, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 jobs amongst whoever the household is to try and actually cover the costs. And that's one of the reasons why the mortgage stress numbers are so high, because, of course, many people are working less hours than they'd like to be able to try and cover all of the costs of the property. And I always say to people, remember, when you buy a property, you've got rates, you've got repairs, you've got all the other stuff that goes with it, right? Those are hardly ever factored in when people do their calculations on cash flow, unfortunately. And just keeping a property up together, you know, it does cost.
Well, I remember discovering my parents had stopped insuring the house during this period. So, and when I discovered that, I think I roused at them anyway, and they found a way to reinsure the house. I couldn't believe it. But it was like that was what they did to actually keep the mortgage repayments going.
Yeah. Well, mortgage repayments are definitely, if you look at the hierarchy of who do I pay first, right, the mortgage, you know, is the one up there. In fact, in my surveys, I've started asking a question about what have you forgone to pay the mortgage, right?
Yeah.
It's quite interesting. So school fees, so taking kids out of paid school, that's quite a popular one at the moment. Or, you know, given up on going out to eat at all, so just eating at home is another one. Giving up on some of the subscription services, that's on the list, right? And not getting medical treatment.
Ooh.
So there's a bunch of stuff that people do to pay the mortgage. So it shows you where psychologically they're wired to think that I've got to pay the mortgage, you know, whatever. And now I've even got missing meals. Mm. It's not good.
So these are people that have actually lost hours or lost work.
Correct.
Due to COVID.
Plus a huge mortgage. So quite often on the Homeland Package Brigade, you know, 95% mortgage or whatever, double income was required to be able to get the mortgage, and now just they don't have the hours. And it builds and builds and builds and builds. Mm. And you mentioned refinancing. I see quite often people do refinance, and they can refinance once because they can extend the term of the mortgage a bit to try and actually reduce it or even go interest only for a bit. But almost always it doesn't solve the problem.
Well, no, and it wouldn't. And if you've down one income, you probably wouldn't. You'd have problems refinancing anyway.
Correct.
So yeah, this is where responsible lending gets me, right? Because you know they've got these spending. What do you call it? Your your cost of living, your living costs thresholds and stuff like that, the assessment thresholds.
Yep.
And it's like, well, if someone's circumstances have changed, responsible lending should allow them to get into a cheaper product, but it won't because then they can't reapply because they won't get their old loan back. And I think that's a real, that's an elephant in the room.
So I talk about mortgage prisoners. right? Mm. And the mortgage prisoners are the people who are still in those higher interest rates because they can't refinance to the lower rates because they no longer actually fit the underwriting standards. So they're trapped on a higher interest rate loan. They are regarded as a more adverse risk, right?
That's all. Yet they're already a customer.
I know.
It's just wrong.
It is wrong.
That is absolutely wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. And remember that Frydenberg was trying to remove responsible lending obligations completely. Luckily, maybe I had a little bit.
Well, it might help those people.
Maybe.
You know, that, I mean, they are trapped by responsible lending.
Yeah. but the question is, should they have gone in there in the first place, right?
No, but once they are, you know, it's a bit like once you've bought a dog property, right? It's like you already own it, okay? Now let's look at it. Let's look at it, you know, or a flyer. It's back to that flyer, floater, flop, you know, with the floaters. That's the conversation I have with people that already own it. So I'm not going to help you buy one, but since you already own it, let's assess it. Let's see whether it's going to cost you more to get rid of it or keep it.
Yeah. Well, my view is that the government, unfortunately, has been responsible for a lot of the creation of the problem because of bad policy over 20, 30 years. You know, interest rates have been very low. Nobody wants to see property prices go down, but we've built ourselves this edifice, right? It's like a pile of Jenga. You know, if you go back to that Big Short film, right, which is a very good illustration of the problem. We are in that little late stage now where the Jenga pile is a bit wobbly, right? Nobody wants to mention the fact that it's a bit shaky. They just want to palm more stuff on the top. The trouble is that the taller you build the tower, the more likely it is ultimately to sort of wobble dramatically. Right? Oh. So.
Yeah, now we're back to you doomsdaying again.
I'm sorry.
The whole property market is overvalued by 40%. Oh, it didn't happen this year. Don't worry, it'll happen. It's just I got my timing wrong.
No, I just run different scenarios, right? So it's not my only scenario, but there is – in terms of long term, right?
You don't think the whole property market is anything, do you?
No.
I'm just.
I always go much more granular than that and look at individual postcodes and individual types of properties. So,
Well, there's plenty of individuals that have lost 40% on their property.
That's true. That's exactly right. And that the difference is between the whole market and, you know, individual stories. And unfortunately, there are still people losing money now. Right. Going back to your pain and gain
report. Sorry. And actually, Kent Lardner, he's actually come up with an index and I need to look at it again. It's Kent's loss, what does he call it? Anyway, he's factored in, he's basically looked at areas with a – he's done a similar thing, but basically he's plugged in sort of a nominal cost of $70,000, you know, for costs over ownership. And the actual, I should have checked it before coming on here, but the data, the stats that he's suggesting just from that in terms of real losses is a lot more alarming. Mm. So this happens day in, day out, even in a booming market. And this is where people have to learn a healthy respect for property.
Yes, that's right. Again, it's got to be beyond the you can never lose on property, right? You know, it always double every 7 years regardless, right? Doesn't matter what you buy, you'll always win. I mean,
just get on the market. Just get on the ladder. Just get on the ladder. Having said all that, property's done me very, very well. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But it's not a be all and end all, and not everyone should invest in it. And, you know, and also you're not a failure if you don't buy a property. It's just find something else to invest in, you know. So we've got to I love that question. It's very overvalued. I guess you don't own property because that's what everyone who doesn't own property says. But unfortunately, when you do own it, you don't agree. It's just
if you're an owner of a property, then you know the last thing you want to see is the values go down because on paper you're a millionaire or whatever, right? On paper, right? Because you never know until you actually find a buyer.
Actually,
remember, the price of a property is worth what somebody's prepared to pay for it.
Yep, you just want a property that lots of people want to pay for it at some point.
Now, we're running out of time, but just before we finish, a couple of people asked me in the chat, where are the best sources of information, right? You know, CoreLogic or Domain or whatever, right? There are a few of those portals around, which I often say be careful. But in New South Wales, of course, you can go to the Land Registry and you can actually get full transaction history for every property in a particular road. And I recommend people go there rather than actually look at the property portals personally.
Yeah, well, look at it all, right? Because the thing is, in the property portals, what you can get is a link for the last sale, and you can look at floor plans and you can compare. And, you know, that information is very valuable. In fact, can I plug a little free course, Martin?
Yes, of course.
We've got a little free course on Home Buyer Academy, and literally the link is homebuyeracademy.com.au/free course. And the little course is a pricing, it's how to price a property. Now, what it doesn't do is index, right? So in a rapidly rising or falling market, you do need to actually index, right? It doesn't teach you that. I've got to create a course that does that. But what it will teach you to do is actually research recent sales, okay? And there's a spreadsheet in there that you can use and all this sort of stuff, right? And does the market need to correct, by the way, Zana, just so you can afford to buy in there? Because that it doesn't work that way. But anyway, but you do really need to you know, do your pricing research when you're, you know, you're working out what to pay for a property, okay? And so that's a really great little resource. It's a little three short videos that teaches you how to price a property. And that's, you know, that shows you sort of data sources as well. And the other resource that I use quite a lot is Suburb Trends, to suburbtrends.com.au. It's a very useful website. You can look at heat maps. You can look at, you know, inventory levels, days on market, yields. There's heaps of data in there. A price segmentation graph too is really useful for looking at different segments within a suburb. So it's for every suburb in Australia, I think, is covered in that, I do believe.
Yep.
Very useful for suburb data.
I use that too as well in terms of, you know, helping to round out. And that's the point. You've got to go to multiple sources, right, and do a bit of work and then put your own story together. The worst thing is just to go into one of the property portals and looking at the last ask and assume that's the beginning and the end of the story. Unfortunately, that's deceiving.
True. But I have to say, though, the domain and real estate, if you do look at an individual property and you go in, there's two different parts. You can look at, like, the last time it was listed for sale and then the actual property data for that particular property. They do tend to line up pretty well with what's on the paid databases that we use. We use CoreLogic and also PriceFinder. They do tend to line up. They're a lot better than they used to be in terms of what you get. But you have to look at a lot of different data points.
Absolutely. Now, we're running out of time, but just a couple of quick acknowledgements. Yogi Bear, groom and wash the stuffed dogs. Thank you for that super chat. Really appreciate that.
Stuffed dogs.
And last one for tonight from ATTS. Love the chat. The ultimate question then for you both would be your advice for home first-time buyers do other than lifestyle factors, i.e. buying in. In other words, what's the real drive, right? Which goes back to your fundamental question about, so why are you buying in the first place?
I like living in my own home that I own. I enjoy that. I don't want to be renting. I don't think the rental circumstances, if people can afford to buy their own home, I don't think the rental is a great option at this stage in this country. I don't think renters are looked after well enough. And, you know, maybe the build to rent becomes more of a market segment and provides better options. But potentially that might be more, you know, more of an option. And I hope it will be, because let's face it, not everyone is going to be able to afford their own home, and people want security, if tenure. So for me personally, there's a psychological benefit in owning your own home, but there's also a financial benefit. If you do buy an asset that does go up in value over time, even if it happens to be a B grade, you know, like, I'm not, it's great if you can always buy A grade. Sometimes B is okay, right? If that goes up over time, and then you are going to live in it for a long time, you're going to enjoy that home, that area that it's in, all that sort of stuff for a long time, you're going to retire owning your own home. You are going to be financially better off than someone who doesn't, right? So there are lots of, and also, let's face it, it's tax-free gains in this country. It's hard to, you know, get any income with, or any gain without paying tax. So there's financial benefits on a number of levels. And so if you can, and if you can buy safely and wisely, then I advocate for it. But if it's hugely risky and you're piling in and you're really under the pump you know, you stretch financially, you're buying a poor asset, you're setting yourself up for a lot of stress, and that is not a good life.
Absolutely right. So it's important to make good decisions based on good information, right? And sweep away some of the, you know, the noise and the froth and everything else and the spruiking, right? Because there is a place for well-selected property.
Yes. Right?
Absolutely clear on that. Property can go up. My property has done quite well over the last few years. Unfortunately, not everybody makes the right decision and sometimes property goes down. But it is tough, and it's important to make the decisions on the right basis and use the right information, the right tools. Because if you make the right decision, it can be very positive. But if you make the wrong decision, unfortunately, the mess can be pretty significant and take a long, long time to clear up. And unfortunately, there are some people in that boat at the moment.
Yep, there are. I'm always heartened when we talk to our students at Home Buyer Academy and that they are getting it right in the right order, and they're also not rushing it, and we actually have 10 steps, right? In we call it a PACE system. There's four phases: preparation, action, commitment, and execution. And in the action phase, step 5 is actually to revise and correct. That's the stop. It's an action phase, but it's actually to stop and review and make sure you're on the right path. Make sure that all your assumptions that you're working on earlier on actually are the right assumptions. And it's a really important part of the process. And so it helps people avoid that sort of FOMO-driven activity. And it helps obviously clarify, should I wait or should I jump now? You know what I mean? So these are all very tough questions for people to consider. And in a rising market, like I forgot the person's name who kept saying it's overvalued, it's got to correct. You know, I get it. That's what you feel when you're in this at the mercy of this, but it doesn't work that way, you know? And so therefore you can make it work for you, but it's about learning how it works and doing the work, as Martin says, and then making good decisions.
Absolutely. And run the counterfactual, you know? So what if my assumptions aren't right? What if it goes in the other direction? Can I cope? And, you know, for me, that discipline of just, you know, playing the negative as well as the positive, and I'm trying to keep a balanced view, because it might go up, might go down, you know, everything might go well, but it might not. That is really worth doing before you get into it, because you can then know that even in an adverse situation, things will be sustainable. Because the last thing you want to do is to force to sell the property at the wrong point. Forced sales are not happy at any time. So,
no.
Veronica, I want to say thank you very much. As always, we've filled our hour and a half plus, and we could go on for another 2 hours quite happily chatting about this stuff, right? Because there's so many. But I think, you know, hopefully that people found that helpful. Certainly in the comments, I've been very positive. Thank you for your time once again. I'll put the links and things to all your various activities below, because there's a lot of really useful information, tools, videos, conversations. The Elephant in the Room is a brilliant series of podcasts, you know, I do recommend that particular series. You guys cover the issues really, really well, and thank you for your time tonight. We must do it again sometime soon.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take you off air now. See you later. Bye-bye.
Adios.
There you go, folks. So interesting conversation. Thanks for all the questions. Thanks for all the comments. And a very interesting chat with Veronica, as always. Just to say that next week, Robbie Barwick's coming on, and we're going to talk about the financial fig leaves. So in other words, what are the things in the financial system that nobody wants to talk about, and what are they covering up? So that'll be worth watching. And I hope that you'll be able to join us next week for the next live stream. Meantime, just watch the recorded shows the rest of the week. If you don't have time to come next week, you can always watch it in replay. So thank you very much for your time this evening, for spending some time with us. Have a good evening. And we'll see you again next time. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.